being here, and I want to, for the next a little over an hour, we're going to talk about disqualification and recusal. And I want to introduce you to our speaker. Mena Ramon is the general counsel for the Texas Office of Court Administration. She's been the general counsel there since 2009, and she's been with OCA for 13 years. She also worked in private practice and with the Texas General Land Office for over 6 years. In her role as general counsel, she works with several judicial boards and advises the special committee that review appeals of denial of judicial records. And she did her undergraduate work at the University of Texas and also went to law school at the University of Texas. And let's give a warm welcome to Mena Ramon. Also, I have some handouts here reflecting the very recent changes that are happening right now in disqualification and recusal. I think I hit most people. I'll come around and get anybody that did not get one yet.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Thank you all for being here. I think what we're going to do first is an exercise in checking to see how awake we all are. As Mark alluded to, and I don't know how familiar you are with this, but there was a bill that was passed this session. It hasn't been signed by the governor, but it hasn't been vetoed yet, that actually specifically addresses recusals and disqualifications in municipal court. So the PowerPoint that I had been working off of for all of the prior classes is no longer, well, on September 1, we hope, will no longer be applicable. So I quickly, in the last week or so, redid my PowerPoint to address the new law, and that's what Mark's handing out. So if you look at your tab, this is the test, disqualification and recusal, the very first document in there is is the bill. It's HB 3475, and it's about 4 pages. And then what I need you to do is just take everything out up until the last page of the PowerPoint that's in there. So the first page will look like Rule 18A, and the last page will be the last page of the PowerPoint that's already in your book. And you can just set that aside, and you can look at it later for comparison purposes if you like, or you can just toss it. And so then what you're going to have is the bill, the new PowerPoint, and the next page that's left starts with Rule 18A again, and then there's an article from the Municipal Courts Education Center that was published earlier. I think for historical purposes, that article talked about the confusion that we had with recusals and disqualifications in municipal courts, and I think it's just interesting to have. Okay. Did everybody get that? Sort of? Okay. I'm really sorry about the confusion. But okay, so how many of you all have actually had a motion to recuse or disqualify filed against you? Okay. Did that go smoothly? Yeah? Did you all use 29.012 to handle it? The general, did you let the parties kind of go to another municipal court judge, or did you have another judge in your court that was able to handle it? Okay. Okay. So the objectives of this one-hour talk are going to be to distinguish between disqualification and recusal, to identify the laws that govern it, and then to describe appropriate procedures related to both. So the people that just walked in, do you have the new PowerPoint? Okay, great. All right. So why this topic? Well, we all know that it's good public policy in order for the public to have trust and confidence in the judiciary. You must be not only be impartial and unbiased, but you also have to give that appearance. I mean, that's just part of being a judge and what makes our judicial system so great. And it's also required by the Texas Code of Judicial Conduct that says a judge shall perform judicial duties without bias or prejudice. So it is your duty as a judge to establish and maintain high standards so that the integrity and impartiality of the judiciary is upheld. That's just your job as a judge. But why else would we address this topic? Last March, this is kind of what started the whole we need to fix 29.012 of the government code That's a provision in law right now that addresses what you can do when there's a recusal or a disqualification in your court. There was confusion among the presiding judges of the administrative regions when a municipal court judge called them, because they usually just deal with district court judges or statutory county court judges. Their feeling was, municipal court judges aren't in our purview. We don't really have anything to do with you all. You're supposed to handle that locally. Well, we had a judge that did that, and the party filed a complaint with the Judicial Conduct Commission, and the judge received a private order of additional education in, regarding his duties as a municipal court judge. So the Municipal Courts Education Center thought, well, we need to get a slot put in our training so that we can educate everybody and tell them what they need to do. So the Judicial Conduct Commission found that the judge had violated Canons 2A and 3B2. The judge had denied two motions that had been filed to recuse him without referring it to the regional presiding judge, and then continued to take action in the case. In his defense, it really was very confusing, and if you picked up the phone, like I said, and called the regional presiding judge, depending on which one you called, they weren't always online with what their responsibilities were, and that sort of left the municipal court judge, you know, kind of at a loss as to what to do locally. But as far as I know, that was the only Judicial Conduct Commission reprimand that was received. But disqualification and recusal, they are not interchangeable terms, even though people use them together all the time and sometimes file joint motions. So disqualification is defined under Black's Law Dictionary as to divest or deprive of qualifications, to incapacitate, or to render ineligible or unfit. Recusal, on the other hand, is the process by which a judge is disqualified on objection of either party or disqualifies him or herself from hearing a lawsuit because of self-interest, bias, or prejudice. Well, the reality in Texas is that recusal is actually more than just a process. There really are grounds, and there's case law that has identified it. But you can see how even in the definition, they are using disqualification as if it's the same. And they both involve self-interest and bias, but a disqualification is a much greater degree, and it's usually not as subjective. It's sort of, if you fit one of these, you're disqualified, end of story. Whereas a lot of times with your recusal issues, it's sort of a fact question. You have to determine how has the judge displayed that he's biased, or what is that connection somewhere, somehow, that maybe would somehow lead the judge to not be as impartial as they should be. The effect is also very different. If you are disqualified, you are deprived of the authority to act, and anything you do is actually void. And if you are disqualified, this is not waivable by the defendant. Unlike recusal, that's when a judge should not preside because of bias, prejudice, or self-interest. But if a person doesn't file a motion and raise it in a timely manner, then it's waived. It's not something that automatically renders everything you do void. And the grounds aren't as severe, or so that's why there's a difference. So just to go quickly, I wanted to give you a quick background on disqualification. It first showed up in our Constitution in 1845 and was provided in each Constitution since then. It hasn't changed much since 1845. It's that the judge might be interested. Either party is connected by affinity or consanguinity, and when the judge was counsel in the case. All other grounds before recusal came into being were rejected. If you were not disqualified, regardless of the appearance of your bias, courts held this judge is not disqualified, the judge can continue. It wasn't until 1972 that the American Bar Association came out with a model code of judicial conduct. And then in 1974, Texas adopted the ABA's recommendations for recusal and put it in Canon 3C1 of the Code of Judicial Conduct. But courts continued to maintain that if a judge was not disqualified, the judge didn't have to step down. Their position was, the model rules and the Code of Judicial Conduct, they're good in practice, in theory, for you to look at, but they're not mandatory. So in 1977, the Texas legislature went ahead and took care of the issue, and they put a statute in place that provided a procedure for litigants to file a motion either to disqualify or recuse. The problem is they didn't put any type of grounds. It was just a procedure. So finally, in 1981, the Supreme Court adopted Rule 18A, and it included the same procedure that was in the legislation, and then the legislature in 85 repealed that. And then finally, in 88, the Supreme Court adopted Rule 18B, which actually lists specific grounds. So there's two ways to for a municipal court judge to be disqualified. In the previous PowerPoint that I had provided to you all, I actually had three because the rules of civil procedure also apply to municipal court judges. But like I said, effective September 1, when this new legislation goes into effect, the rules of civil procedure aren't going to apply to you all anymore. And so that's going to leave these two remaining: the constitutional disqualification that I just talked about, and then the statutory disqualification in 30.01 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. So the constitutional disqualification provides three grounds. The judge was counsel in the case. Like I said earlier, the judge may be interested in the outcome of the case, or one of the parties is related to the judge. And the counsel in the case, it's pretty broad. Even giving advice on the matter is enough. You don't have to have been an official lawyer. Even having been involved in making recommendations or suggestions, even if you didn't think you were necessarily serving as a lawyer. It is okay to be counsel in an unrelated matter, but if it's the same matter, then you can't. The interest has to be very direct, and it has to involve money. So it's very, the case law that supports this is, it has to be direct, and there has to be money. And then the last one is the relationships, which are also included in the Code of Criminal Procedure. You can't have been related to them within the third degree of consanguinity and affinity. So I'm going to go through the statutory disqualification because this is probably the one that your litigants raise the most, even though they're very similar to the constitutional disqualification provisions, but they kind of just take into account the criminal nature of your work. So the Code of Criminal Procedure provides that you're disqualified if you're the injured party, you were the victim, if you acted as counsel for the state or the accused, or you're connected to the accused or the party that was injured by consanguinity or affinity within the third degree. And they specifically provide where you go to make that calculation. I don't know that much about figuring out consanguinity and affinity, but apparently in old case law, there were different ways of doing it, but now this specifically guides you to the government code. So we'll first address has been counsel for the state or the accused. A trial judge is not disqualified from sitting because he was counsel in other prosecutions against the accused. How many judges do we have here that have been prosecutors before? Have a couple of you all? Okay. And if you were a DA or a county attorney, it's not enough that you were the DA or the county attorney. You actually have to have worked or participated in the case. Not just because something is sitting in your office wasn't enough. I know in some places you're it or you and one other person, and so it's possible that you are going to be disqualified. But there is case law that says if you didn't know about it, you didn't work on it, then you're not disqualified. So does anybody have any questions? No? The next prong, if you were the injured party, this includes your property as well as your person. So if someone dinged up your car or broke your house window, that's enough, or any of your property. And you don't have to be named in the indictment. There's some case law where the indictment says everything the person did, and the judge knows it was his property or his person, but he was not named in the indictment, and the court said it doesn't matter. It's whether you were actually, in fact, injured. So the next one is the relationships between up to third degree of consanguinity and affinity. The government code provision 30.01 refers you to chapter 573. The only thing I want to caution you about that is if you were compelled to pull up chapter 573 to look at how you determine that, this section is actually the statutory provision for nepotism laws in the state that have to do with other things besides recusal and disqualification, like hiring school board, school staff, etc., county employees. And for nepotism, the restriction is third degree by consanguinity and second degree by affinity. And so I've just put this little reminder to let you all know that you use the Chapter 573 calculation for determining how you're related to people, but for judicial disqualification, it's third degree for both consanguinity and affinity. I went ahead and I listed in the next couple of slides the provisions where you actually, they set out in law how you determine it. But basically, you're related by consanguinity. Those are blood relatives. So one is a descendant of the other, or you share a common ancestor. And adopted children are considered to be children of the adoptive parent for this purpose as well. So computing consanguinity by third degree is pretty easy. It's basically the generations going up and down. So it would be your parent or your child. That's one generation up and down. Your brother, sister, grandparent, or grandchild. That's the second degree. And great-grandparents, great-grandchild, aunt, uncle, nephew, niece are third degree. And I provided a little visual because sometimes it's easier to look at that. And put everybody in where they belong. So everybody on that wheel, you're related to within the third degree by consanguinity. So you are disqualified from hearing a case that involves them. Affinity is the relationship that's created when someone is married. And it not only affects who you're married to, it also affects your blood relatives who they're married to. So this one has like two prongs. So basically, to determine if you're related to someone by affinity, you have to look at all of those people you're related to by consanguinity within the third degree, anybody that they're married to, those three degrees, their spouse is related to you by affinity. So it's your blood relatives who they married. And then if you're married, you're obviously related to your spouse by affinity. And then the people that are related to your spouse by consanguinity, their blood relatives in the third degree, all of them are related to you by affinity. And I went ahead again, and sometimes it's easier. I could not do a wheel that was large enough to put everybody, but I went ahead and listed everybody. And so you don't really have to commit it to memory. You can just pull it up. And there's a lot of tables on the internet if you ever have a question. So what do you all think happens in the event of divorce or a death to a relationship that's established by affinity? So the ending of a marriage by divorce or the death of a spouse, it ends that relationship unless there was a child of that relationship. If a child of that marriage is living, then the child is considered, that affinity relationship stays forever. So sometimes you have divorces in families. If they didn't have children, you're not related to them anymore by affinity. If they did have children, you're still related to them. So I threw in a test here. Is a judge disqualified from sitting in a case if the victim's brother is married to the judge's daughter? Actually, I think if you go through our consanguinity wheel, so this is the victim's brother. Isn't it outside? judge's daughter. So you have the judge's daughter, but it's the victim's brother. So that's not her spouse who he's related to by affinity. It's his brother. So technically, that's one more step removed. So sometimes it sounds like you're related. Now, someone may raise an issue that you aren't going to be, you can't be impartial in that case. And that would be something that you could either resolve. You can decide, I don't think I can be impartial in this case. Like maybe you all go on vacation all the time and you're really close, but you're not technically disqualified, which, again, that means you can't sit. Everything you do would be void. So if a person were to raise a disqualification, you could say no, but they could also file a motion to recuse. You could decide whether you wanted to or not, or have someone hear the motion for you and make that determination. So, going back. So how is a disqualification raised? Although a motion can be filed, a person doesn't actually have to file anything to be disqualified. They can just tell you out, flat out in court. If it's something you don't know about, sometimes perhaps there may be a relative or some other kind of, some involvement you had in the case that you don't recall, then they don't have to actually submit anything in writing. They can just raise it in court. So whenever someone raises a disqualification issue, you have to really prick up your ears and not be so concerned with the actual procedure as to what's been raised. I mean, the practical matter is most people put everything in writing. It's easier. So you can raise it at any time, unlike recusal where there's a timing issue, and if you don't do it in time, you've waived it. You could wait if the person did it at the very last day of the case. Whether they knew about it or not, you're still disqualified. So the other judge I worked with on this presentation, he wanted me to throw in this slide that it's really important for you to kind of be aware of the cases that are in front of you and of any possible involvement or disqualification issues, because you don't want people to kind of go through the process trying to see how it's going to work out, and then if they don't like the outcome, raise that disqualification motion and see if they can get a better shake the second time around. So, and again, the courts, disqualification is so big and it's so important for the establishment of the impartiality of the judiciary that even if you don't know about the relationship, you're still disqualified. So let's say this was a long-lost relative. You'd never even heard of them, had no idea you were related to them. The issue is raised. You are disqualified. And the court that held that said, while we in no way question the integrity of the trial judge in the case at bar, we feel that an absolute rule unaffected by the existence of knowledge to the judge of his close relation to the defendant assures the public that in all instances there will be no possibility of bias. And lastly, on disqualification, if you're disqualified and you continue to preside, mandamus is available to compel you to step down. So now we get to recusal. Does anybody have any questions on disqualification? Nope. Okay. So on recusal, I've gone ahead here and I put the two canons of the Judicial Conduct Code that address impartiality. 3B1 says a judge shall hear and decide matters assigned to the judge except those in which disqualification is required or recusal is appropriate, and 3B5 that says a judge shall perform judicial duties without bias or prejudice. 3B1-2, you need to keep in mind, you don't want to recuse yourself at the slightest possibility that maybe someone will think I'm not impartial, because you actually have a duty to hear your cases unless it's actually appropriate. A lot of times it's so close that it's okay to err on the side of recusal, but you don't want to become one of those judges that at the slightest, hint that maybe, because people will raise that, and once you become known as a judge that's always going to be stepping down, then you also that also affects your ability to be a good judge. So I throw in here applicability of Rule 18A of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure to criminal cases. Right now, under the current law, the rules of civil procedure apply to you all. The legislation that I'm talking about doesn't go into effect until September 1. Okay? So I just want to make that real clear right up front. The rules of civil procedure had applied to us because there was a case, Arnold v. State, where the Court of Criminal Appeals said they apply in criminal cases absent any explicit or implicit legislative intent indicating otherwise. And up until this session, there hadn't been. And as far as I know, there hadn't even been anything filed in the past. This was the first time. And I think it was the result of that complaint that was filed with the Judicial Conduct Commission that really spurred everyone to kind of fix the problem. So the explicit legislative intent came under HB 3475. It's the first three or four pages in your packet. I've set it out there. As of this morning, I checked the website, and it's still sitting on the governor's desk. So I'm hoping that that's a good sign. It hasn't been vetoed. I know that the Municipal Courts Education Center will certainly let everybody know when it passes. I know they're already talking about doing charts that would put all the procedures out. But if it were to be vetoed, I know they would let you know as well. So this provides the procedure for the recusal and disqualification of municipal court judges. It tracks the procedure in Rule 18A. It also tracks the procedure that's found in the government code for the recusal and disqualification of statutory probate court judges. So there's other law out there that had set out these procedures in addition to the rules of civil procedure. And it repealed 29.012 of the government code. And for those of you who may not remember what that provided, I went ahead and I pulled this out of our previous one. I thought I did. It basically said that if a judge is disqualified or recused in a pending case, the judge of another municipal court located in an adjacent municipality may sit in the case. And the problem with that is it really didn't provide any procedure for how you were supposed to do that. Who was supposed to assign the judge in the adjacent municipality? Who was supposed to contact them? I mean, arguably, if you've been disqualified, you're not supposed to be acting or doing anything in a case. You're disqualified. In some instances, the judges would have the parties go work out who they were going to go to. There was no consistent handling of this process before. And so now, with this new legislation, you're going to have a set process. Oh, and I do want to go back to one more thing. I'm sorry. As I was preparing for this presentation, because while the legislation was pending, our office was contacted, the Municipal Courts Education Center was contacted, and I know the Municipal Courts Association, they were all very involved with this legislation as it evolved. It didn't look like this when it was originally filed. And, you know, we provided comments and suggestions and thought it looked good. Well, as I was preparing for this session, though, it dawned on me that it provides procedures, but it doesn't provide grounds. And recusal, it's the only place in our law in Texas where we have the grounds is in the rules of civil procedure. So I'm going to make an argument that even though the rules don't technically apply, there is case law on, you know, situations that involve the grounds in the rules where it's established when a judge is or is not biased, and that people are going to use those when they file their motions. And I think it's just good practice for you to be aware of them so that when you if you have to make your own determination. So I didn't put them in there because in my haste to fix this, I thought, oh, we don't need any of the Rule 18A or B information, so I'm going to throw it out. So if you don't mind, I just want to briefly go through the grounds for you. And if you'll go to the place in your book, I have it in there. It's called, it says Rule 18A. I think it's like the fifth page from the end. And if you'll turn to Rule 18B, Grounds for Disqualification and Recusal of Judges. subsection 2 has the grounds for recusal. And I'm just going to talk about them real quick. So the first one is that a judge shall recuse himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might be reasonably questioned. And the second one is the judge has a personal bias or prejudice concerning the subject matter or a party or personal knowledge of disputed evidentiary facts. Well, just for your information, the two most common causes or reasons that people file motions or the grounds they allege are that the judge is impartial or the judge has a personal bias or prejudice. I mean, all the rest are great, but most of them are going to be those two. So the judge's impartiality might be reasonably questioned. This has been interpreted to mean that a reasonable person on the street with knowledge of all the facts would question your impartiality. It doesn't even have to be that they find it, but they would question your impartiality. Now, they can't base this on what you've done in court. For example, some judges have a reputation of being really tough on crime. And so if you end up in their court, it's going to be a tough sentence. That is not a ground. It's not what you do in court. Now, on the other hand, if you've been quoted in the newspaper as saying, I'm the toughest guy on crime, don't ever come to me for a speeding ticket because I'm going to yada, 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 which I know you all wouldn't do, but if it was that kind of situation, then that would probably apply. So, let me see. The judge has a personal bias or prejudice. The impartiality question, that's a difficult one because people, they throw it out very broadly, but they don't necessarily pin specific items. Where when you're talking about a personal bias or prejudice concerning the subject matter, they usually can find specific instances and will raise ways that you've actually shown this. You know, always rolling your eyes when the defendant's speaking or, you know, your overt actions that actually show this. So those are the two most common. The next ones are pretty self-explanatory. Whoops, I'm sorry. Just forgot that it's not on here. C is the judge or a lawyer with whom the judge previously practiced law is a material witness. That's not that difficult to determine. The judge participated as counsel, advisor, or material witness in the matter in controversy or expressed an opinion concerning the merits of it while acting as an attorney in government service. This kind of can go back to that acting as counsel in the case. There were those very set parameters for when you were disqualified, but perhaps you didn't actually work on a case, but your office is so small that there's no way you couldn't have known about material issues related to the case, then maybe that's something that a recusal would be appropriate, even though disqualification is not. The next one is the judge individually or as a fiduciary or the judge's spouse or minor child residing in the judge's household has a financial interest in the subject matter in controversy or in a party to the proceeding or any other interest that could be substantially affected by the outcome of the proceeding. A lot of these are more geared towards civil cases. Do you all have any thoughts about how this would apply in a criminal case? I was thinking that what if it was your spouse's boss that was in front of you, maybe?
Restitution issues. I mean, there's an issue of restitution
mm-hmm.
in a criminal case.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. The next one is F, the judge, judge's spouse, or a person within the third degree of consanguinity to either the judge or judge's spouse is a party to the proceeding or an officer, director, or trustee of a party or known by the judges to have an interest that could be substantially affected, or to the judge's knowledge likely to be a material witness in the proceeding. And then the last one is the judge or judge's spouse, or a person within the first degree of consanguinity to either the judge or judge's spouse is acting as an attorney in the case. Again, that's kind of a fact issue. You either are or you're not. So, okay, so moving on then. The new legislation has a new section 29.052, and it provides the procedure for a motion for recusal or disqualification. And it actually uses both words, motion for recusal or disqualification. If you'll recall, earlier I said you don't need a motion for a disqualification. And I don't think that the fact that the legislation or the new statute says that a party may file a motion for recusal or disqualification means now that they have to, in fact, file a motion. Because in Rule 18A, that language is also in there, and there's case law where the judge has held, we know it's in there, but it's not necessary. So I just want to clarify that. This law does not change that. So it has the procedural requirements. They have to file it within 10 days of the date set for trial. It has to be verified and state with particularity the alleged grounds. And I put this out here for your information. If you get a motion and you think it's flawed for any of these reasons, it is not up to you to make that determination. I think you need to know this. But it's either going to be the person, the judge who's actually hearing the motion can determine this, or, I mean, if you decide to recuse or disqualify yourself, then it won't matter. They have to give notice on all parties or their counsel. They provide copies of motion and a notice that they expect that it be presented to the judge 3 days after the filing of the motion, unless the judge orders otherwise. So I went ahead also and I put, there's case law regarding the timeliness of the motion. Again, it all relates back to Rule 18A. I think the courts are going to use the same analysis that the judges have used for timeliness issues regarding to Rule 18A. The language is basically the same. And so again, you have to file it within 10 days or it's waived. Unless a party, you know, there's good cause, for example, when a party didn't know the basis with until, you know, somewhere in between that timeline. So what do you do when a motion is filed? You basically have two options. You can actually look at it and say, okay, they're right, I need to recuse or disqualify myself. Or you can say, I don't think I should be recusing and I'm certainly not disqualified. I'm going to go ahead and refer it to the regional presiding judge. And they're going to assign someone to hear this motion and make that determination. I've gone ahead in all these slides. I've put the new statutory provisions that will be coming in to effect September 1, so you can find these. So if you recuse or disqualify yourself, and this provision, it says with or without a motion. So, yes?
Quick question. Mm-hmm. The request for the regional presiding judge.
I think it's, you know, I don't know that it has a time limit. I think you need to do it immediately, I mean, as soon as possible. I'd have to look at the legislation, I'm sorry. They have to immediately set it before then. There's this sense of urgency. So, okay. Whoops. So if you choose to recuse or disqualify yourself when you're presented with a motion, or let's say you didn't get a motion, but you think you should recuse yourself or disqualify yourself, you're going to enter an order of recusal or disqualification. And if you are not the presiding judge of your court, you can request the presiding judge of your municipal court to assign another judge in the court to hear the case. And the presiding judge of your court can hear it as well. If you are the presiding judge of your court, then you need to refer it up to the regional presiding judge to make an assignment to another judge in your court. And if you're the only judge of your court, then you request the regional presiding judge to assign a judge of another municipal court in the county to hear the case. So if you're disqualified, you take no further action. If it's a recusal issue, you can take action for good cause stated in the order, but I would caution you strongly that there are very limited circumstances where you should take any action at all. So who are the regional presiding judges? Have any of you all ever had any dealings with your regional presiding judges? And in the same? Right. And I think in their defense, you know, you all are judges. You only want to do what you're authorized to do. And the legislation, the statutes that deal with their duties are very specific, and they never mention municipal court judges. They have no jurisdiction over municipal court judges. Everything that says if they can assign judges to hear motions, to hear heavy dockets, etc., always have a specific list of judges they can use, and municipal courts just never came into the picture. And so their feeling was, it's not that we don't want to get involved, we just don't feel we have the authority to be involved. So they were also very happy to see this legislation, I could tell you. So there's 9 judicial regions in the state. They're all appointed by the governor. They serve 4-year terms. They can either be an active or retired district judge, or a former district judge with 12 years of experience, or a retired appellate judge with judicial experience on the court. I went ahead and I put in a map that shows you where you fall within your regions. And the very last page in your tab here actually has a directory. It has the names, their addresses, phone, and fax. And if you ever have a question, you know, there, I would recommend that you call them. So if you decline to recuse or disqualify yourself, what do you do? You forward again to the regional presiding judge an original or certified copy of an order of referral, the motion, and all opposing and concurring statements, and you take no further action. So unlike when you're doing it on your own, you're actually recusing and disqualifying yourself, where you could turn to your presiding judge of your municipal court. If you are not going to recuse or disqualify yourself, you need to refer that motion to the regional presiding judge. Then upon receiving the motion, they're going to immediately set the hearing before themselves. And I put himself, they're all males. And they're either going to assign a sitting district or statutory county court judge, or a judge who is eligible to serve on assignment under Section 74.055. And that's basically their list of visiting judges. They're either former or retired district statutory county court judges who have decided they want to continue doing judicial service, and they get assigned to hear cases as needed. So, and then they'll give notice of hearing. And I think the best part of this legislation, in my opinion, that Rule 18A does not have, is that they can conduct these hearings by phone unless a party objects. I actually envision that most of the presiding judges are going to try that first. It won't cost your municipalities to have a judge come in and hear these motions. And so that's what I think they're going to try first. And then next, they wanted to make sure they had another free way to do this, no cost to the municipalities. I think they would then set an active judge, a district or statutory county court judge. No. No. The question, did y'all hear the question? The question is you as a judge, if the motion to recuse, are you required to participate in the hearing or provide anything or be present? And you're not. As a matter of fact, it's suggested that you not. A lot of times judges, when they end up getting recused, it wasn't because of the original motion. It was because they went up there and wanted to testify and then, you know, displayed all sorts of bias. They took it personally, and at that point, the judge that's hearing the motion is kind of caught between a rock and a hard place.
What I saw once was a district judge who hired an attorney to represent his interests. And the attorney went to the hearing and did all that.
Yeah. That is an option. So what you should not do is ignore or overrule the motion. Transfer the case, enter any orders, and here it says voluntarily participate in a recusal hearing. So now you have a judge that's been assigned, they hear the motion, and they determine that you should be recused or disqualified. So what happens next? Again, this sets out a procedure similar to what happens when you recused or disqualified yourself. The law tried to start kind of local, handle it at your court before we go up the chain or outside of our municipality. So if you are not the presiding judge of your court, It instructs the judge who hears the motion to request the presiding judge of your court to assign another judge of the court to hear the case. If you are the presiding judge, then you're going to have to request the regional presiding judge to assign again another judge in your court to hear it. Or if you're the only judge of your court, request the regional presiding judge to assign a judge of another municipal court in the county to hear the case. If the presiding judge of the municipality is unable to find another judge because there are no other judges in the municipality, or all the judges are already recused or disqualified or otherwise unable to serve, then again you request the regional presiding judge to assign. And it gives a specific order. First, the judge would go to a municipal judge from another municipal court in the county, and if not, then they can go to a municipality in an adjacent county. Okay. And then lastly, I went ahead and I didn't have the slide, but what if the regional judge, the regional presiding judge, is unable to find another judge? And again, if there are no municipal judges in the county or all of them have been recused or disqualified, the regional presiding judge can assign a municipal judge from a municipality in an adjacent region to hear the case as well. So that's the end of my presentation. Like I told you, I think the Municipal Courts Education Center will be letting you know when this actually comes into effect. And I think, yes, Mark? I did not. Did you want me to talk about it a little bit? Okay. If you all, I wasn't sure whether to bring this up because there is a little bit of, it's going to cause some confusion for some in some areas. And I think when I was talking about the judges who hear the motions, why I think the presiding judge is going to want to hear it himself or assign an active judge, because municipalities, I don't think they're used to paying for other judges, and certainly not district court judges or retired judges to come into their municipality to hear motions. But in the legislation on page 6, it provides that if it's one of those judges on that list, section 74.055, those are those retired judges that have agreed to continue serving on assignment, they're going to be entitled to compensation of $450 per day of service, prorated for any day for which the judge provides less than a full day of service. Now, that can be interpreted hourly, half day. I mean, because the reality is that these motions do not take that long to hear, most of them. And I think that people may balk at having to pay $450 for a judge to come sit for an hour. And there is a similar provision in the law regarding assignment of judges to cases in district courts and statutory county court, where if they only work half a day, they get half a day's pay. So there is some precedent for that. And if the judge hasn't worked a full day, then that's definitely going to be an option. If they're an active judge, then the only thing they're going to be entitled to is travel, if there was any. So I don't, you know, some of you are probably in municipalities where a district judge does not reside, so there may be some travel involved. But that's all that would fall there. And then the one that I think is going to be a little more difficult is subsection B, 29.060B, where it says a municipal judge assigned under this subchapter to hear a case in a court other than the one in which the judge resides or serves. So if it's your municipal court, then obviously you're not going to get paid extra because you're already being paid to be their judge. But a judge that comes from another municipality is entitled to compensation provided by law for judges in similar cases, as well as travel expense. And my understanding is that a lot of you all are part-time judges, and your compensation, it's different. Everybody does it differently. And so there's a question of whether they would be compensated the way you're compensated, or do you compensate them the way they're compensated? If they're a full-time judge, should they be treated more like a regular district or statutory county court judge where you're getting paid regardless of whether you show up at your court house in the municipality you came from, why should we pay you extra? So this is the area where I think it's going to be. Before it was procedure, and now I think you may end up with a compensation question that'll come up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
That you would only use in case of disqualification.
Absolutely. And I know that Ryan from the center, the general counsel, he definitely recommends that, so that you actually have someone available that the presiding judge can assign. I would also strongly suggest this legislation also added a requirement that city secretaries or people that do that kind of service for municipality provide to the Office of Court Administration the list of all of the elected officials and municipal court judges, because the other problem these regional presiding judges have is they don't even know who you are. And if you have people that you have alternates that only come in once every 6 months, they're not going to know who these people are. So we're hoping that this provision will provide a good list, so that the regional presiding judge calls and says, I need the list of judges in X municipality, we can provide that to them. But if it hasn't been done by your elected or appointed city secretary, I would strongly suggest that as soon as this law passes, and that you do it regularly, that you provide the Office of Court Administration with a list of your judges and their contact information. I think it'll make it a lot easier and not create problems when they actually need to find somebody. And then it'll make sure that there's compliance with the law, even if it wasn't the right person that did it.
I'm going to excuse myself in the case. And my prosecutor contacted the JP and asked him if he would send information. So he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I also sent in on the case for him. Is that okay?
So did everybody hear the question? Sorry, let me go ahead. Just because they're taping this, do you mind?
Well, I had to excuse myself from a case. So my prosecutor contacted our local JP.
Right.
He heard the case for me, and then at another time, I heard a case for him. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know if that was proper.
See, I think under this, under the new law, under the old law, it's all very ambiguous, and it's sort of what, you know, if your presiding judge says handle it locally, that is a good way to handle it. When this law goes into effect, I think when you recuse or disqualify yourself, you have to let the judge, the presiding judge, know. It's not up to the prosecutor anymore. Now, I guess they can dismiss the case and refile. That would be, or, you know, the equivalent. But if you are the judge and that case is still sitting in your court, I think you're going to have to follow the procedure in the statute now, effective September 1. I just based on how this works in the district court scenario, the prosecutor doesn't really have that option. I mean, that's, and maybe you all disagree, but I really think that you have a statute now that says what you as a judge are required to do. And if it's, I think you need to follow that procedure.
I just wouldn't want someone to be able to say that I violated the rule.
Right.
And that would be the first thing.
Right. I think what the judge was saying, just for the purposes of the recording, is that now she feels that if she doesn't follow this, then that someone could say that she violated the rule, and that in itself would show some bias, because she works with these people and she sort of is allowing this to happen. And I just kind of in a nutshell. And I had a thought and it's escaped me. Well, and if you keep in mind, when it was confusing and it wasn't clear, the Judicial Conduct Commission held that you were supposed to refer it. And I think now it is very clear. I think there's legislative intent that says municipal courts, y'all have been handling this in this way. Y'all haven't been doing it consistently. Everybody has a different regional presiding judge. But we're going to set out the standards, and here they are. And I really think, I agree with you, Judge. I think you need to follow that procedure. It protects you, and you still have jurisdiction over that case. And it says if a motion is filed, that's what you do. So, the only thing also I wanted to get back to the cost issue. when I ask you all how many of you all have had to do this, it doesn't sound like it happens that often. I mean, am I wrong? It doesn't happen. Right. Well, so the question is, just again for the sake of the tape, is now that there is actually a specific law, aren't the defense attorneys going to want to file this every time? The cities aren't going to want to pay for this, but it's not discretionary. They're gonna have to, and like I said, I really think that the regional presiding judges, I mean, they hear a lot of these all the time. I mean, it is a very big, growing practice in the district courts. Pro se litigants do it all the time just for the sake of delay. They hear those motions, and I mean, they're just, some of the judges, frankly, they see the information, they'll get them on the phone, and we're talking about 5 minutes. I don't mean to say that they treat them lightly, but they are used to seeing this pattern or these delay tactic where they just throw stuff out there. And it's possible that there may be more, but I'm hoping that at least in terms of hearing the motion itself, that there are mechanisms in place that won't cost the municipality. The only way it'll really cost, because I think the presiding judge is going to hear it, preferably by phone. And if they can't, they're going to get an active district judge, and hopefully it'll be someone that lives there or is very close, so they're only going to pay for travel expenses. And unless you're actually recused or disqualified, and which, frankly, if you are, you shouldn't be in the case anyway, it shouldn't cost that much. That's what I'm hoping. But there may be an increase in motions. Mena, I guess we'll see.
In two or three of the versions I looked at during the process, there were specific clauses in the statute, and I don't know what ended up in this final version, where that said something along the lines, if it is filed merely for delay tactics and without any, you know, good cause, that I think there could be some penalties shifted back to the person filing that for that reason.
And I do think that ended up in the legislation.
At one point, there was talk of, like, reasonable attorney's fees, I think, right. You know, so there were some built-in penalties to try and prevent the very issue you're talking about, people using it as a matter of course every time.
It says they can fine the party filing the motion in contempt under Section 21.002C.
Yes, yeah, so you can use contempt. They could use contempt powers.
Right. So.
Okay.
Any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. So our next classes will start at 9:20, so you have a little bit of time now. I think we're going to have cruelly treated animals in here and problem properties nuisance abatement across the hall. But we'll come back at 9:20. No sign-in sheet on this one. This is not a TxDOT class.
You can, and hopefully they'll be available and aren't also recused or disqualified. But it's good to have someone that the regional presiding judge can assign.
Mm-hmm. We're very nice kind of home as well. Next town over.
Right.
We haven't
had to
do it.
Right. Yeah. Okay, sure.
Hi,
Judge.
Say hello.
Oh, hello. Nice to
see you in person.
Right.
Thank you so much for all the work you did.
Oh, no.
Really
well, very glad that.
Oops.
I know.